Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian for the week of the 22nd of February 2010. I'm Alex Krotowski, and this week there's a whole trove of news and analysis that we'll be discussing over the next 30 minutes, including the argument against the open software movement.
The idea of free and open access sounds good at first. The reason it's not good is having everything freely accessible to everything else actually just creates this mediocre mush. The wisdom of crowds only works when, like, the crowd is choosing a price of an ox, when there's a single numeric average that actually matters. But if it's a design or something constructive, that average is a design by committee that's crap.
That was philosopher, musician, and former digital utopian Jaron Lanier. In addition, Bobby Johnson, our man on the streets of Silicon Valley, speaks with the geeks who are taking technological solutions from San Francisco to the developing world. We'll also have the latest news headlines from around the web and feedback from you, our faithful listeners. Keep your ears peeled.
We're here in San Francisco's Mission District in Four Barrel Coffee, which is a lovely, lovely place. They're very kindly hosting us this evening. And I'm talking to some people working in some very interesting sort of social enterprises related to technology. We have got Mark Summer from Invenio, Heather Fleming from Catapult Design, and Mike McCaffrey from Architecture for Humanity. Hello to everyone. I'm going to ask you to all give me, like, basically give me your 30-second pitch for what you do, and then I'm going to start drilling you and asking questions. So let's start with you, Mark. Tell me about Invenio.
Invenio is a non-profit organization. Our mission is to make the technologies of computing and communications more available to organizations who serve impoverished communities in the developing world. We have a focus on sub-Saharan Africa and just started working as well in South Asia. What this really is about is being able to use computers and communications in places like schools, microfinance institutions, healthcare centers. And the way we go about doing that is by getting the right equipment into the hands of these organizations who do the work on the ground, and by working with entrepreneurs in the IT space together and train them and get their skills up so they can maintain and support this equipment and have new income opportunities supporting those organizations.
Heather, Catapult Design, tell me, what are you up to?
Catapult Design, we're a nonprofit product design firm, and we actually share office space with Invenio in a new shared space called Mission Social. But what we do is we design new products and technologies for our clients, which are typically grassroots nonprofits or social entrepreneurs in developing countries. So we'll design things like small wind turbines for electricity, fuel efficient cook stove, LED lamps, things like that.
Excellent, very concise as well. Mike, can you give me your pitch for Architecture for Humanity?
I guess the short pitch is we find innovative design solutions to help communities in need around the world. Essentially, we design and help construct buildings, whether it be community centers in Asia or schoolhouses in Africa or new types of housing in Mississippi. And we have a community-focused design. We work with partner communities to identify their designs instead of just coming in with sort of an idea made up ahead of time of what exactly they need.
All right, so now we've got everyone. That's the base. You know, we can build up from there. I wanted to ask a few things. First of all, since we're here in San Francisco, there's a lot of non-profit work. There's a lot of interesting social enterprise that goes on in San Francisco. Is this the best place in the world to do the job that you're doing?
I'd have to say it's a good place to go just because of the technology. I mean, we're working around the world, and we have to work with communities, and we really... All of our interactions with them is online via Skype and our own websites and platforms that we're developing. And just being in the Bay Area with its high concentration of tech sector expertise, it makes it easier to develop the tools that we need in order to keep in contact with everyone else. So our focus isn't working here, but the tools that we get here allow us to work everywhere.
And Mark, I mean, your projects are much more IT-focused. Is there a fringe benefit from being here, or even a first order benefit?
There's definitely a huge benefit for us to be here. We're very close to the people who design the equipment we use in the end of the day, and we can actually go back to them and say, hey, if you would do the slight design change, we could use it so much better in those areas where we work. But on a different level, I think the Bay Area is really an interesting area, especially San Francisco here. to do this kind of work. It's very innovative. The people here are very socially conscious and minded about the impact. And it's a place which constantly innovates, I think, on new models to do things. And that really works well for us. There's one big downside for us as well, which is that we're from a time zone location, just in one of the worst places to do work in Africa and Asia, because we're far away from all of it.
You don't have to tell me about the time zone. But anyway, Heather, for you, I mean, like Mark said, you know, he's close to the people who are designing and building some of the stuff he's using. Is that the same for you? Are the kind of base technologies that you work on and work with, are those guys around here? Does that make it easier?
We actually get a lot of criticism for being designers for developing countries and working out of San Francisco. But I have to say, just for the same reasons that Mark and Mike have highlighted, it's easier for us to actually work out of San Francisco than it is for us to work in some rural part of Kenya. There's a huge talent hub here for designers that we can pick and choose to work with whenever we need, and they can come in at a drop of a hat. Things just move so much faster here, and with tools, you know, the internet and Skype, we can still get access to our partners on the ground. And then a lot of Catapult's value add is just in connecting the dots. And by being in the Bay Area, surrounded by all these other nonprofits, it's just so much easier to connect to those dots. It's kind of beneficial to be here.
Are the non-governmental organizations you guys work with or connect with, how switched on are they about technology and the sort of developments that you're interested in?
I'd say Architecture Humanity, our partners are very interested. We partner with different organizations around the world, and we do a lot of schools with UNICEF. We're working with Football for Hope now to build sports centers around the world. That's also with Nike, and they're very excited by technology, especially online design competitions. They're really excited to get new ideas crowdsourced, in quotation marks, from around the world.
Do you mean cheaply? Is that what you mean by crowdsourced?
I guess, yes. Perhaps a better way to put it is they appreciate the interest that people have in giving their time to help good projects really get off the ground and have innovative solutions to meeting these communities' needs.
And Mark, some of your projects are funded through grants. Some of them are funded through contracts with governments in the countries that you work. How do they feel about technology? Are governments in some of the poorest countries in Africa, are they switched on to the stuff you're trying to do, or are you turning up and having to explain it to them?
It depends really who you talk to and where you talk to them, and I'll explain that. Local organizations or the representatives of large organizations who are locally really very well understand the need of technology, because they're constantly faced with technology in the capital city, and once they go to the project sites where the actual beneficiaries work with, they realize there's nothing around there. You can't communicate well, you can't use technology, and things take so much longer and are so much more inefficient because of that. So locally we have a huge support and huge understanding for the kind of work we do, and we see a lot of the headquarters type organizations get pushed by their local staff to innovate and bring in more technology and come up with new ways to do this. On sort of the headquarters level, may it be the Washington DC level or the Geneva level or wherever those organizations might be based, often it takes a little while longer to get to the right people who really see the benefit and as well see that it's possible to use technology in those really tough environments in a sustainable way and really achieve cost savings overall or impact increasements over time of doing that.
Heather, that's something I wanted to pick up that Mark just mentioned, actually, was the technologies that get used in these harsh environments or in difficult situations. And that's kind of what you specialise in working on. What are the differences? I mean, what's the difference between a wind turbine that you might have in the US or the UK to one that you might want to plonk in Uganda, say?
Depends on the goals of the organization. A lot of the organizations we work with are trying to build local manufacturing skills or local economic capacity. So the difference is if you were to take a wind turbine that was distributed in the UK and tried to build that in Uganda, you likely would not be able to do it just because maybe they don't have CNC machines there, or they don't have lathes. So a lot of the innovation with products for developing countries comes from taking things that already exist but trying to rebuild them for cost and for manufacturing in these countries. And also around distribution models too, because it's such a risk-averse economy and people don't have a lot of money. Is there a way to turn products into more service models than just putting things on a store shelf and expecting people to buy it?
So one of the things, we talk a lot about how technologies can save the planet and save the world or go to the bottom of the pyramid and help people lift themselves up and kind of revolutionize their lives. How do you guys feel about that? Is that something that gets overplayed? Is the sort of the... I'm hoping you're all eternal optimists because you kind of have to be in some of the areas you work in. But is it something that you have to temper, you know, the excitement with the realism?
Well, funny you should use that because that's actually my boss's job title. He's our CEO, our chief eternal optimist. So he travels around the world being optimistic. There's basic needs that people have that really aren't being met, not only for technology, but obviously just, you know, our organization, just shelter, and I guess it's also technology, but of a different sort, just new building materials. And really, I mean, that's the focus. I mean, we really need to move technology down, technology and design down to the people who don't currently have it.
Mark, what do you think?
Obviously, when we as Invenio talk technology, we really mean computers, networking, and all those kind of things. And people often say, why do you need computers out there? Don't people need food? Don't people need basic shelter and those kind of things? And I always like to go back and say, so what would have happened if we wouldn't have had the internet come up in the last 15, 20 years? How have things actually changed here? And it's such a huge impact these type of technologies make. Just what cell phones have made for an impact in Africa and other places of the developing world. And so do these technologies. They make microfinance possible, really, because you can't do it in a manual way with just books and papers, effectively. For medical professionals, being able to communicate properly between each other, exchange information, saves lives every day. For organizations who work in food security, being able to communicate with farmers more effectively, talk about different techniques and all these kind of things, that is a tangible impact every day for people in their lives. On top of that, you really spur innovation locally, because it's very hard to innovate locally if you don't have access to resources to communicate and build your capacity and exchange notes with other people who are looking into those kind of things. Communication is really key for that, and that's what we see in every day where we work, that really takes hold and makes a huge difference and huge impact.
And I remember we've done a lot of stuff about, you know, technology, communication technology in the developing world, and talking to people like, you know, ministers in Ethiopia, you know, Addis Ababa, they're trying really hard to leapfrog and say, you know, we can't install landlines, but what we can do is use WiMAX to blanket the country, and that may actually help us in the future, and we'll be more advanced than, you know, than Western developed countries, you know, who nobody wants to use WiMAX around here. But Heather, do you come across those same problems? Do people look at the work you're doing and say, you know, surely you should be giving food out to kids who need it rather than designing a wind turbine?
No, I think our stuff plays well into those issues, and we end up don't have to justify a lot of our technologies. Maybe that's just because we're based in the Bay Area, where everybody's already pro technology, and when clients come to us, it's because they already have something in mind. But I feel like the issues that we run into more frequently are around scale, and everybody has seen stories in their local newspaper around a university class or a local genius who built a solar cook stove or something like that for developing countries and how it could save millions of people's lives, yet nothing is really happening with any of those projects. You never hear about it actually saving millions of people's lives. So, I mean, a lot of that is just around the realities of distribution of technologies in places where infrastructure doesn't exist for that sort of thing. So we always try to temper people's expectations with, yes, you know, engineers and designers can produce great things, but there's a second part to the story around actually implementing and distributing these technologies, and that's kind of the bigger challenge that I don't really see a lot of groups addressing just yet, but it's certainly a huge chunk of the problem.
I think it was the now cliched phrase from William Gibson, wasn't it, that the future's here, it's just not evenly distributed, which seems to apply here. Anyway, I'm going to wrap it up there, so thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Bobby. You can find out more about all the projects that were mentioned and all their relevant links on guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Now here's this week's news.
Nearly 3 years after plans to create a new internet domain specifically for pornography were blocked, the idea could be back on the table once again. An arbitration panel has ruled that the original decision to prevent the introduction of a new XXX adults-only domain should be reconsidered. Original proposals for the domain that would help people filter out explicit material if they wished was originally blocked by ICANN, the group that administrates internet addresses, in 2007. Investigators are closing in on the source of the internet attacks that hit a string of US companies, most notably Google. Last weekend, two Chinese schools denied involvement in the attempts to steal private information and trade secrets. However, a report in the Financial Times suggests that US officials have tracked the individual that they believe authored the computer code that was used and have linked his work to Chinese officials. The Labour Party has begun its social media campaign, with Twitter playing a prominent role in plans for the general election. Activists, MPs and candidates are putting new media training to good use, highlighting their efforts with the hashtag Labour Doorstep. The party website will also be used to collect donations and volunteers, with both YouTube and Facebook playing an important part for video content. And Microsoft is about to start offering Windows users a web browser choice screen, as required by an agreement with the European Commission's Competition Department last year. As part of the testing process, some users in the UK, Belgium and France will see it next week, and it will be rolled out in 30 European countries next month, but not worldwide. The browser choice screen was preferred over Microsoft's earlier decision to ship box copies of Windows 7 without a browser at all.
Next week, we'll have more on the Microsoft browser story when Charles speaks with Opera, the company that initially brought the case to the European Commission. You can read more about these stories at guardian.co.uk/technology. Jaron Lanier was one of the original digital utopians. Hanging out with the early adopters and revolutionary thinkers 30 years ago, he envisaged an electronic frontier when people would reap rewards from sharing themselves online. Now, after the 3 decades of the internet and the subsequent World Wide Web in action, musician Lanier has changed his tune. He now believes that web users are being duped, performing tricks for the machine rather than the other way around. He believes the open software movement has made us technological proles in a digital Maoist new society. I spoke with Jaron about his manifesto, outlined in his new book, You Are Not a Gadget, and began by asking him what it was that changed his mind about the web.
Long ago, say 25 years ago, some friends and I had this thought that perhaps the internet would be such a fountain of wealth and opportunity that it could be entirely open. People could essentially give away the fruits of their brains and hearts, and the opportunities that they would get in return would be huge. And unfortunately, I've come to believe that that was a huge mistake, and it's not based on ideas, but just on data. As I look at the real world of musicians and writers and all, I see that it isn't working. I see that we're not finding these legions of new middle-class musicians who are making it without the studio system or something like that. We're seeing very tiny token numbers of people who can get a little bit of publicity for giving something away and then are never heard from again. And it's just not good enough. Consider the advice that sometimes is given to musicians: give away the music and sell the t-shirt. And the problem, of course, is that it won't be many years at all until there are extremely cheap, practically disposable robots that can make any t-shirt design you care to off the internet. And then the value of that custom t-shirt goes to zero, just like the value of music you rip off the internet and burn on a CD. We really are faced with a stark decision. Either we create a way for people to live off their brains in the future to earn dignity, which has to mean not having to constantly sing for their supper. Or we have to accept that our project is socialism and that we're trying to shut down personal reinvention and self-determinism and want to create a system where people will be universally supported by some institution. And I certainly choose the former. And I call it digital Maoism because, unlike other Marxists, the Maoists had this distaste for people who were earning their living from their brains or from their hearts. And they practically worship the peasant or the person who's really toiling. And every time we tell somebody, give away the music but sell the t-shirt or whatever it might be, we're saying, don't make your living in this more elevated way. Instead, reverse the course of technological progress as far as social progress and ways to make a living and choose a more and more physical way to make a living. So we're sending them down towards towards peasanthood again, very much like the Maoists have.
Can you explain a little bit more about what it was that helped to transform your thoughts from, in many ways, a libertarian ideal into what now you've termed digital Maoism?
It's not libertarian because libertarians believe in money and commerce. I mean, that's the thing, is that the people who call themselves libertarians online are not at all. They're really some variation of either Maoist or anarchist, but absolutely not libertarian because they're disavowing money as a means to make a living. You can't sort of pretend, okay, we're 17 years into the web, we just should wait another 17 years. It's long enough. It's long enough to say we've performed an experiment. It was a worthy experiment. There's no shame in having a hypothesis that doesn't turn out well, but there's a tremendous amount of shame that should accrue if you ignore data about how your hypothesis turned out just because you don't wish to see that data. And at some point, we have to acknowledge what we're seeing.
So what is the solution then?
I propose something like 5 different approaches to a solution. The one that I'm the most hopeful about of those 5 is to return to the very first vision of the web, a universal micropayment system. As far as you were concerned, there'd only be one copy of each creative thing, just like there's only one copy of a YouTube video or one copy of something on the Apple Store, and you pay a half penny or something every time you access it. What we're doing right now with things like the iPad and the Kindle and Xbox Live and so forth is we're creating these empires that each have their own accounts, and people can only possibly accommodate a small number of those just for practical reasons. So we're creating this big studio system where everybody will have to go through one of these 8 biggies or 3 biggies or whatever it turns out to be. I'd much rather see a world of open access. And in that world of open access, something remarkable would happen. Every once in a while, when you make some quirky comment on a blog or a news story, or you upload some little video clip, all of a sudden it'll hit. And instead of just a moment of fame for your pseudonym, you'll get $50. Or $1,000 or something. And the very first time that happens, you'll realize that you're a full-class citizen, that you have the potential to make money from the system. And then once you hit that point, you'll realize, hey, there's a social contract here. And this free file sharing stuff denies me the benefits of this social contract. And then you might stop file sharing for the same reason you don't break into houses or cars, even when you could, because you realize it's part of a way of living that's actually good for everybody.
I can see, though, that people would quite quickly learn to game that system, that, you know, in many ways you've got the 50-cent bloggers in China, or even Gawker. It offers its bloggers a certain amount of money for when they put something online. And ultimately, some people would argue that would produce a lowest common denominator. People would then seek to earn back based upon what they think would be a hit. So how would you balance that?
I have no doubt that you're right. What should happen instead is there should also be a micro-investment to enter the system. So there should be tiny amounts of postage on email. That would shut down spam immediately. Mm-hmm. The idea of free and open access sounds good at first. The reason it's not good is twofold. One is that having everything freely accessible to everything else actually just creates this mediocre mush. The wisdom of crowds only works when, like, the crowd is choosing a price of an ox, when there's a single numeric average that actually matters. But if it's a design or something constructive, that average is a design by committee that's crap. So what you really want is encapsulation. You want to have people who are able to introspect. You want to have groups that are able to get their ducks in a row and test results and think big thoughts before they share.
You present a really compelling idea that the software designers are actually psychologically manipulating us
just through the very nature of how they're designing their systems. They're engaging us, they're using us in many ways in order to facilitate their particular applications. Do you think that they're actually aware of this, or do
no,
you think that they're just like,
I'm not,
this works?
I'm not suggesting a conspiracy. Mm. It's not a conspiracy. What it is instead is religion. There's a certain confluence of a set of ideas which give a new strategy for the denial of death and aging and so forth, which was invented by Alan Turing. And Turing came up with this notion of this proposal for person-machine equivalence. Turing offered this blueprint that you can sort of imagine that people and machines aren't all that different. And so one stream, not the only stream, but one stream of technical culture took that approach to heart and eventually formulated a replica of traditional religions with a technical terminology. So instead of the rapture, we have the singularity and so forth.
Could you describe the singularity
for
people who
yeah.
don't?
Oh, the singularity is when all the computers suddenly get so smart that they take over, and then they're so capacious that they scoop up the contents of our brains, and we get to live forever, and blah, blah, blah. Given that there's this theological drive to equate people and computers, more and more designs have that quality. So one of the reasons that the Web 2.0 stuff suppresses individuals and brings out this mob identity is that that allows us to pretend that the machine is becoming intelligent and doing work, and we do that by suppressing the people. So Larry Page can say, oh, you know, the Google server is coming alive, but that's only possible because we don't see the people behind the curtain.
One of the arguments that you've presented is that culture is disintegrating with things like Web 2, things like mashups. You don't view those necessarily as cultural artifacts.
Obviously, all of culture depends on something similar to a mashup, but the difference between real culture and fake culture is, do you internalize the thing before you mash it? Does it become an expression of you? Is there some way that your experience, your meaning, your spirit, your understanding has actually touched this thing? Or is it just cut and paste digital, a touch of novelty for a moment to get some attention? A deep mashup, you actually internalize the thing. And when it comes out, it's both a reference to what was and also something about you at the same time. It's also expression. So culture involves some work, some risk, some exploration, some surprise. Cheap mashups are entirely the opposite of deep culture, but you know, reference and reuse are obviously the very core of culture too.
Can you see anything good that's come out of the open culture movement?
No, I think it's been a disaster, in particular, there's a generation of people who hold the ideals of the open culture movement as talismans of their identity and their friendship and all that's good in the world, and I'm so sympathetic to that, because I had to hold on to ideas that were wrong for many years. The open culture idea has been an absolute failure on every level. I really think. I mean, everything that it can point to is either a nostalgic recreation or something that has existed in a far better form. Let me give you some empirical examples. If you compare the apps that are available on the iPhone or Apple ecosystem to the Android one, it's clear that the Apple ones are just better, more polished. And that's because it's not just that people have a potential to make some money, but also on the Apple one, even though many people rightfully object to Apple's approval process, at least it does create a bit of an encapsulation. So somebody has to get their act together and say, okay, this is the thing we're submitting. And that forces things to be holes. And with the Android thing, it's like this, everything's kind of crappy. And anyone can see that. I mean, it just wouldn't be honest to claim otherwise. If 30 years ago I had said in one of my talks, in 30 years, computers will be millions, millions of times faster, and the great prize we'll have is a new Unix release and an encyclopedia online. And everybody say, that sounds pretty boring. You know, it's like the lessening of ambition. People have been so excited about the ideology that they don't notice the actual stuff. Every little bit of it existed anyway. I mean, I'd love to be able to say that there's some really great thing from the open culture movement. I just can't find it.
What about from the web in general? I mean, as a digital optimist, what would you...
I think the web in general has been this massive success story. The web gave us the first empirical evidence that vast numbers of people really are creative, really do have things to offer, and really will do it. The stuff I don't like is just this Web 2.0 stuff that regiments and anonymizes people. The mob mentality stuff. I think that's a huge wrong turn. But the web and the internet overall are just incredible successes. A total joy.
That was Jaron Lanier, author of You Are Not a Gadget. You can see more of this interview in video format and can read even more on Jaron's thoughts in the article that was published in The Observer. Catch them again on guardian.co.uk. This week, we've had plenty of feedback from you across all of our social media channels. Over on Facebook, the irresistibly named Rylan Phylong Allen Holy commented on last week's interview with Vark.com, the social search company recently purchased by Google for a whopping $50 million. He's used the service himself and says, "Aardvark is incredible, just what I needed. And I think the weird thing is that I feel compelled to answer questions too," which actually addresses one of the criticisms that we had about the service. On Twitter, T42 asks, "What happened to the discussion of Australia's internet filter? A line of inquiry which we unfortunately dropped when our emails were filtered by Australia's overactive firewall." Only joking. Seriously, we've had trouble pinning down anyone to give us the definitive lowdown. Back on Facebook, Matt Legg has requested a new photo for our Tech Weekly logo. Do feel free to choose one from our Flickr pool. I personally think that we should have producer Scott on the front cover. Finally, we're looking to host a live recording of this podcast in the next few weeks in London. So, who of all of the web visionaries out there would you most like to talk to? Send us a tweet on @GuardianTW, write on our wall at the I Love the Guardians Tech Weekly podcast Facebook group, or comment on the blog. All the links are available on guardian.co.uk/techweekly. That's it for this week. Many thanks to the team and to our guests from the Digital Entrepreneurs in San Francisco. That'll be Mark from Invenio, Heather from Catapult Design, and Mike from Architecture for Humanity, to the larger-than-life Jaron Lanier. Thanks to Bobby Johnson and to producer Scott. Next week, we'll have more on Opera's plans as the underdog in the web browser wars, and we'll be looking at the co-working phenomenon which drives the tech companies to success. Come back next Tuesday. I'm Alex Krotowski. Thanks for listening.